Do you think bananas are healthy? Think again. I'm Dr. Stephen Gundry, best-selling author of the Plant Paradox series, and on the Dr. Gundry podcast, you're going to learn the foods to eat and the ones to avoid to lose weight, boost your energy, and feel your most vibrant, active self this year. You'll also learn simple tips from the world's top experts on health and nutrition. Plus, you'll discover the truth about calories, how running could actually be hurting your health, and why fat won't make you fat. Subscribe now to the Dr. Gundry podcast on Apple, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you get your podcasts. Because I'm Dr. Gundry, and I'm always looking out for you.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Dr. Drew Podcast. Again, keep the support and the wind in the sails of the Corolla Pirate Ship. We appreciate that so much. And do check out drdrew.com. Also, I announced to Gary today how much I'm having fun over at TikTok. And I'm learning at that TikTok. It's the craziest thing. The fact that people spend so much time thinking about condensing information into 60 seconds, if you really follow scientists and the clinicians and things, and business people, there's a lot of stuff to be learned there. But I, too, am active there, so follow me at Dr. Drew and also the Instagram, Dr. Drew Pinsky. And it's all at the website, so check it out there. And don't forget our streaming shows, which you can check out most days. Today, it's my privilege to welcome Dr. Rick Doblin. Website is MAPS, MAPS.org. Dr. Doblin is the executive director of Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies. People have been asking me for some time to get a good representative from MAPS in here, and finally – we have pulled it off, and we are delighted to have him. You can follow all the MAPS information at MAPS on Twitter, at MAPS News on Instagram. And of course, there's a YouTube, which is pertinent specifically to the study, one of the studies we're going to be talking about today, MAPS MDMA. Dr. Doblin, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I'm so glad to be here with you.
So before we get into the paper that you're so excited about and I think is going to be fascinating into adding hopefully some interesting therapeutic interventions to the spectrum of what we can do with assisted PTSD therapy, tell us about MAPS first so people know what that is if they are not already familiar. And then we'll talk a little bit about psychedelics and therapeutics before we get into the study. How about that?
Okay, that sounds great.
All right.
So MAPS is a nonprofit organization that I started in April 8th, 1986. So, and it was started after MDMA was criminalized in 1985. Huh. So MAPS, Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies. I felt I needed the word psychedelic in the title just to be like a flag to attract people. MDMA was used therapeutically from the middle 70s to the early 80s under the code name Atom. And it leaked out of those circles and began to be used as a party drug under the name Ecstasy. I learned about MDMA as Atom in 1982. And it was clear that there was going to be the backlash because there was already sales under the name Ecstasy in public settings. And this was Nancy Reagan and Ronald Reagan, and escalation of the drug war. So I started a nonprofit before MAPS, connected with Buckminster Fuller, actually, in 1984.
Huh. I didn't know about that connection.
Yeah. It was called Earth Metabolic Design Lab. It was a nonprofit that a friend of mine had in connection with Buckminster Fuller, and he wasn't using this nonprofit. And we needed a vehicle for suing the DEA to try to keep MDMA therapeutic use legal. And the nonprofit Earth Metabolic Design was for new forms of energy. And we said, okay, that can count psychedelic energy.
That's a new kind of energy.
We can figure that out. So we sued the DEA. We slowed them down from criminalizing. The DEA administrative law judge said it should be Schedule 3, which means illegal for recreational use, but legal for medical use. The administrator of the DEA ignored the recommendation, which was heartbreaking, and we won a couple times in the appeals courts. But it was eventually DEA lawyers figured out how to criminalize therapeutic and recreational use. Hmm. And so MAPS, I started in 86 as a nonprofit pharmaceutical company, in a sense, with the primary focus on MDMA.
Has there a documentary ever been done on MAPS?
There has been a book on it. There are some people doing documentaries about parts of our work, but the history of maps has not yet been.
It just seems like something that would be so fascinating for people to see, because there's so many issues that pop up right at your birth. It's very interesting. So, yeah, I've always been very concerned – that's the kindest word I can use – about this notion that there are chemicals that are either good or bad, good or evil. That is the fucking most nonsense. I mean – There's chemicals, and there's the effect on the human being, and there's the relationship that the human being has with the chemicals, and that's that. And it's neither good nor bad, evil nor holy. It's just a part of biology.
Well, that's so right. And the core they're just tools, and how they're used is the term. And the core problem with the drug war that we have is that it makes certain drugs bad or good, and
right.
it ignores the relationship. But the best example to illustrate what you're saying is that the only person at the FDA that ever won the Presidential Medal of Honor was this woman, Frances Kelsey. And the reason she got the Presidential Medal of Honor was because she blocked thalidomide from coming into the United States, because there was already some reports about it causing birth defects. It was used for morning sickness. And so thalidomide was the quintessential bad drug, and the FDA got rewarded for blocking it coming into the U.S. But decades later, thalidomide is now a medicine approved by the FDA for cancer, certain forms of cancer and leprosy. So it just illustrates that it's about how something is used.
Yeah.
And then Paracelsus, his famous quote is that the difference between a poison and a medicine is dose.
Interesting. That's really interesting, because all medicines are potentially poisonous. That's exactly right.
Drown in water.
But it's interesting to me. Absolutely. It's interesting to me how – so the because of this making chemicals bad, the only way to dig out from under that is to make them holy and only good, which is what we're doing with cannabis now, right? So it's only good. It's now it's the panacea, only good, good for everybody under all circumstances at all time. And, you know, just like things are not all bad, they're not all good. And it's funny, I'm an internist by training, and I had a family practitioner dad who just drilled into my head that medications are dangerous. Medications are dangerous. You only use them when the risk reward clearly indicates. And that risk reward diathesis has shifted in recent years, where we sort of think of medicines as the solution to everything. You know, we have to kind of get back in the middle somewhere where we just think objectively that these things are, like you said, tools, instruments, helpful. I also get kind of weird about people who get freaked out about drug companies too. Big pharma. Yeah, big pharma's been culpable. They got problems. But using pharmaceutical agents, whether it's a hallucinogenic from a nonprofit or a drug that a large company distributes, what else do I use as an internist? What exactly do you think we do as physicians? What is at our disposal? We have physical therapy. We recommend maybe psychotherapy. Everything else is either surgery or medication. Everything. And I don't do surgery, so I use things to change physiology. Those are called medications. But anyway, that's just my
– Well, to follow up on your statement about people make things holy, that, you know, there's a word – hallucinogen, I don't use that word because that's a negative pejorative word. It's about – it's false. It's delusion. It's hallucination. But – people have come up with a new word for psychedelics called entheogen, which means
empathogen. Empathogen?
Well, no, empathogen is about MDMA, like to promote empathy. But entheogen is meant to reveal the God within. So that's a word I don't use either, because that's slanted positively. It's not true that every time you have a psychedelic, you have a spiritual experience.
Right.
But they're trying to reframe it that way. But I also want to say about for-profit pharma is that I started MAPS in 86 as nonprofit pharma. Since that time, we've raised over $100 million in donations.
That's great.
Which is pretty amazing. But in December of 2014, we started a for-profit pharma company, but it's the MAPS Public Benefit Corporation. So we maximize public benefit, not profit. It's kind of an innovation of capitalism. And it's 100% owned by the nonprofit. So we have the nonprofit owns the for-profit. And it was important for me to tell stories to donors that we're not going to continually ask you for money because there's so many different therapeutic uses of MDMA. We're a rare nonprofit in that we have a product at the end that we're trying to get approved by the FDA, and we could make some money. And then whatever money we make from selling MDMA at a profit, we can use for the mission of the nonprofit, which means more research and more public education.
Fantastic.
And so even us as a nonprofit pharma own a for-profit but public benefit pharma.
Yeah, I mean that makes sense. I've worked for something called the Prostate Cancer Foundation, and they fund amazing research, and they keep wondering, should we participate in the benefit of that research in some small way so we can keep doing what we do? It's a crazy thing when you're a not for profit and you're solely reliant on donations. Yeah, it's hard.
Do you know the Cystic Fibrosis Foundation story?
I don't.
Oh my God. Okay. So this is the best example of non-profit pharma. So, they donated $150 million to this is about 20 years ago now, to a company that to develop drugs for cystic fibrosis. But they retained a percentage of the royalty if the drugs.
It's like that's what universities do.
Yeah, and then this company was bought by Vertex, the for-profit that they invented, and they invented this. They came up with this drug for cystic fibrosis. And then the Cystic Fibrosis Foundation sold their royalty rights to Royalty Pharma for $3.3 billion. Mm. And now they're massively endowed. And now just out of their income, they can fund more research into cystic fibrosis.
Yeah, as long as companies never change, divert from their core mission, I think that's the way to do it. It's hard, though. It's hard when your core mission is really a certain thing and you're also trying to hang on to not to profitable stuff, especially when you're fighting with university. But that's a separate topic. Yeah. I want to stay with the hallucinogen. To the what are we going to call? We're not going to use the word hallucinogen. What should we? Let's just use the real terms: the MDMA and other drugs like that.
Okay, that's good. But one way to find out who's been funded by the National Institute on Drug Abuse is if they use the word hallucinogen.
That's interesting. That's very interesting. what word shall I use so I don't keep slipping into that?
Well, psychedelic or MDMA.
Okay, psychedelic. Has MDMA been your main focus? Is that the drug?
Yes.
For
strategic reasons. Okay. So, I've said to people that if I were stranded on a deserted island, I was a shipwrecked sailor and I was on a deserted island and I could only have one drug, what would it be? And it would be LSD. But for strategic
Why?
Well, because LSD, you just have to surrender to it. With MDMA, you can negotiate with it, meaning that there may be things that I would need to know that I don't want to know about myself or my history. And so with LSD, it's very difficult to negotiate. You kind of can be brought into the uncomfortable new or the uncomfortable suppressed. MDMA is phenomenal, and I love it. And it's for strategic reasons we've chosen it. And I think it's the best introduction to psychedelics of all the drugs. But so it's definitely strategic reasons. And that's why almost of the 100 million that we've raised so far, around 75 million have been spent on developing MDMA into a medicine. And other, we've done a little bit with LSD, with cannabis, with ayahuasca, with ibogaine, but and public education, harm reduction, but it's mostly MDMA.
So I have a million questions now. Did one of the psychedelic areas of research that has always intrigued me is the LSD, psilocybin, and end of life.
Yes.
Is that you guys? And if so, what do you understand about that as a therapeutic?
Well, we did start the first LSD research in about 35 years in Switzerland in 2008, and it was LSD for end of life related anxiety. We also were starting in the early 90s to try to do MDMA research for end of life anxiety. We have since completed a study of MDMA for end of life related anxiety. During the 90s, 1992 is when the FDA opened the door to psychedelic research. Mm. In 1990, they gave Rick Strassman, a doctor, permission to do DMT research, but he was saying that DMT is the only endogenous psychedelic, and maybe you get too much of it in your brain, that's what causes schizophrenia. So it was kind of a negatively oriented study. We were then went to the FDA. They rejected five of our protocols, and we were trying to do MDMA for cancer patients with anxiety. And the reason there was because we need a sympathetic patient population for a demonized, stigmatized drug. And so everybody is concerned.
That's crazy that you have to think about it that way, but okay.
I ended up going to the Kennedy School of Government because I couldn't get a clinical psych PhD because nobody would let me in to do psychedelic research in the 80s. I've got my master's and PhD from the Kennedy School, and that's where I learned a lot about strategy. But we need a sympathetic patient population. And because the concerns over neurotoxicity at the time were so overblown that but people didn't look like they had problems. It was like, oh, you'll get problems later. So we figured if we work with people that are dying that have 12 months or less to live, then nobody can say you can't do the study because they're going to have problems later. So FDA then opened the door to psychedelic research in 92, said they would regulate it the same way they regulate other research, which meant that we had to start at the beginning, which was a phase 1 dose response safety study. And we did that with Dr. Charlie Grobe at Harbor UCLA. And then near the end of the 90s, we wanted to switch back to the cancer patients because the neurotoxicity thing was still growing. We didn't quite have a good enough answer for that yet. But the rave movement had grown and the use of ecstasy had grown. And so Charlie said, no, this is too controversial. I'm going to switch to psilocybin, which people don't even know that that's connected to mushrooms. And so that's how the psilocybin end of life began. And that was actually a good thing because I felt that MDMA is even more perfectly suited to PTSD. And so in 1999, we started the first study with PTSD and then 2000 in the US. And that's where we're at now, finishing our first phase 3 study. But
we're going to get to that. I'm going to talk all about that.
But I'll say that the end of life work is so important.
Yes, I agree.
It
looks amazing. The data looks amazing. UCLA is still doing, as far as I know. And every time I see them sort of peek out and sort of report, it just looks amazing.
Yeah. Well, NYU, Hopkins, it's incredible. Actually, that's working better. It seems like a little bit than the treatment-resistant depression, the sort of depression related to end of life or dying, because that's more episodic, you could say, to a specific thing that you could help people reorient to. But the ego dissolution part of the classic psychedelics helps people to realize that that we're just part of a bigger picture.
That's what they usually report, right? When I read the reports, I also think they're reporting that they can tolerate the dissolution of self. You know what I mean? It's almost an exposure therapy, much the way you're exposed to a phobia, right? Their fear of dying, and we expose you to the experience, and oh, that's something good, so I can tolerate it.
Yeah. Now, one of the classic aspects of a mystical experience, whether catalyzed by psychedelics or not, is this sense of unity and connection. That's the core element. That we're part of everything. And another part of it is the transcendence of time and space, that you kind of get this sense that it's been billions of years of evolution, that we're just a blip, but that everything that came before produced us. And then we become, so it's the E equals MC squared, that energy is the nothing is lost. Mm-hmm. You get that sense that even though this individual life that we're in is temporary, it's that there's something to appreciate about death, that death makes life possible, that it makes life precious.
And you've taken some of these?
I've taken all of them. I can't say I've taken all of these. There's still all sorts of new ones, but but I feel it's part of my job. I have. So yeah, I have. And I've also been trained as a therapist, and I've worked with people in the early days of MDMA with people that were dying. And one of the most moving experiences I've ever had was a woman who was dying in her 30s. The mother was appealed to me to help out the daughter. The mother was taught mindfulness. So the mother and I became therapists for the daughter. And there was this series of experiences. And then several days before this young woman died, the mother and the father came together. They had been divorced. The father wanted to be there. The mother decided to take MDMA with her daughter. I didn't. But the moment that was the most beautiful was the young woman couldn't even sit up. She was so close to dying, but her father took one hand and sat on the one side of the bed, and her mother took the other hand and they sort of pulled her up so that, that she could be facing them. And this woman who's about to die said how beautiful it is to be able to die with your mother and father here with you.
Wow.
And it was like she rose out of the tragedy of this premature death into the beauty of the life that she had had.
Yes.
And it was just exquisite. And also, she had been in such pain for weeks before that she stayed alive only for this session. Oof. And because of the pain, she was under massive opiates, which make you kind of tranquilized and knock you out of it. But the MDMA is MDMA, methylene dioxymethamphetamine. So it has properties to stimulate. It's a stimulant in some ways, and it wakes her up. So the MDMA in combined with the opiates woke up this woman, and the synergistic effect had better pain control than she had in any other way. And so they were able to recapitulate their whole lives together of this young woman and her parents. Jeez. And it was like this miraculous transformation from somebody that could barely speak for a couple of weeks because she was so, you know, tranquilized by these opiates. But then she could come alive for this last discussion to say goodbye to her parents. I think it's going to, now that research has not really been done because people have, you know, this woman was on all these other drugs. There's all these other drug-drug interaction issues.
Yeah.
The work that's being done with people that are with life-threatening illnesses are when they're not at death's door. It's not like a hospice situation.
Right.
It's more, but I do think we need to move into the hospice settings as well. And it would be tremendously helpful.
I completely agree with you. I've become aware that there is a whole sort of world of therapists using plants with psychedelic properties. It's an underworld. It's you know, exists unto itself. There's a lot of people in it, both on the professional side and on the patient side. Are they interacting with you? And they have kind of a different way of looking at things. They talk about the plants sort of informing the experience. They sort of – it's not a biological sort of model they're using. You know what I'm talking about? You must know what I'm talking about.
I do know what you're talking about. I might say for somebody who has done all these drugs and had some mystical experiences, I'm very dubious about some of the, like, the plants speak to me.
I just look at it kind of the way people look at Eastern medicine. It's just a different language. They're describing the same thing. They just don't have a biological frame for it. But
yeah. So I guess I'll say that my fundamental perspective is that the war on drugs, in addition to misguided being, you know, good drugs and bad drugs, it's a fundamental violation of human rights. It's never been about reducing drug abuse. It's always had a political overlay. Persecution of minorities. We see that. There's been a great book called The New Jim Crow about mass incarceration. It's about the reason that Florida is in play as a swing state is because there's so many Democratic leading people who've been African Americans and minorities been arrested and they've lost their ability to vote. So the war on drugs has been about suppression of minorities.
Crazy.
And so it's really something that's my core belief. So therefore, the underground psychedelic therapists that are working, I applaud them for their courage because they are risking their licenses, they are risking their freedom, and they're doing it because they think that the tools that they have from some of their patients will work great, but that for some, it won't. And the tools that they're looking, that we're doing research with, do hold promise to help people who are stuck in other ways. And people are willing to risk their licenses and their freedom in order to do that. One of the things that our therapists tell us who work in our research that's the hardest for them is to go back to their normal patients without MDMA and just to see how they get stuck, but that they could just give them MDMA, that they could make more progress. So the underground movement has been growing enormously. There's very little police activity against it. And ironically, the main way that underground therapists get in trouble is you would think it's because something goes wrong in the therapy and the patient reports them. So underground therapy goes bad and somebody doesn't like what happened and reports them. But that's not actually what happened. What happens is underground therapists get in trouble because their therapy goes well. And the person that they're working with wants to make some changes in their lives. And the people that are left behind are the ones that call the police.
Huh.
And that's how Underground. So we are very supportive of the courage of underground therapists, but they're doing work that shouldn't be so risky. And that's why, you know, we hope that the medicalization through the FDA and the drug development will eventually make it so that we don't need to have this underground.
You may be surprised to learn that health insurance doesn't always cover the full cost of an emergency medical flight. Even with comprehensive coverage, you can still get hit with a substantial deductible or copay. Protect your family and your finances with an Air Medcare Network membership. As a member, if an emergency arises, the expense of air medical transport is completely covered when flown by an AMCN provider. Membership costs as little as $85 a year and covers your entire household every day, even when you're away from home. That is just pennies a day. My goodness. I mean, for that sense of security and safety, why not? We all know that the unexpected can happen. An AMCN membership is protection no family should be without. For a limited time, as a Dr. Drew podcast listener, you'll get up to $50 e-gift card when you join. Again, it's only $85 a year, and then a $50 e-gift card. Simply visit airmedcarenetwork.com/Drew and use code offer Drew. Check out Air Doctor. Air Doctor is a professional quality air purifier with a medical grade ultra HEPA filter, independently tested to remove 99.99% of tested bacteria and virus, plus other things, pollen, dust, dust mites, smoke. That's right, Air Doctor captures 100% of particles at 0.003 microns, 100 times more effective than ordinary HEPA filters, and it can circulate air in a 450 square foot room 6 times per hour. And we've been spending a lot of time indoors, and listen, the EPA will tell you, indoors can be 100 times more polluted than outdoor, and I think increasingly people are aware of environmental hygiene and the fact that it's something that needs attention. Air Doctor will give you that. They use their exclusive professional whisper jet fans. It takes the guesswork out of clean air. In the auto mode feature, using a laser sensor to detect air quality and automatically adjust to the correct filtration levels. It's a professional quality HEPA air purifier recommended by leading medical experts, an effective way to reduce airborne pathogens and viruses and protect your home. Make sure you get an Air Doctor to keep you and your family safe. Air Doctor comes with no questions asked, 30-day money-back guarantee. So if you don't love it, just send it back for a refund. Just go to airdoctorpro.com, use promo code Drew, and you'll receive a 35% discount. That's right, 35% off. Don't know how we do that. But only if you go to AirDoctorPro, AirDoctorPro.com and use that promo code Drew. Well, our friends at BetterHelp, you know I'm a big enthusiast. And this podcast, the Dr. Drew podcast, is sponsored by BetterHelp Online Therapy. If you're struggling with mental health issues, BetterHelp will assess your needs and match you with your own licensed professional. You can start communicating in under 48 hours. Not a crisis line, not a self-help line. It's a professional counseling line done securely. Therapists have a broad range of expertise. Some may not be locally available in your area, but the service is available for clients worldwide. Lock into your account anytime, send a message to your counselor, schedule weekly video, phone, or even live chat sessions. BetterHelp is committed to facilitating great therapeutic matches, so they make it easy and free to change counselors if needed, and it is more affordable than traditional offline counseling, and without the uncomfortable waiting rooms and that kind of thing. So many people have been using BetterHelp. They're recruiting additional counselors in all 50 states, and I have referred family and patients and been very happy with the services. Our listeners get 10% off their first month of online therapy at betterhelp.com/Drew. That is betterhelp.com/Drew. The story about the ones left behind creating the problem makes me think of an interesting question that I didn't know I had. So let me just try to frame it, which is that I feel like in psychotherapy, the patient really is in command of the process, even when they're stuck, right? Is there any sort of ethical issue using biologic? And this is really just a curiosity question. I don't have a position myself, but it's just this whole issue of people getting angry because somebody changes too much. Essentially, it's kind of interesting. Is there any ethical dilemma there? in terms of biology. I always worry, for instance, like let me just say where I come from with this, which is I have had plenty of patients go down and use ibogaine or ayahuasca to try to stop their opiate use and whatever. My experience, just my experience, has been that it rarely works long term. It always works for about 6 months. But in the cases where I've seen it work, there's a personality change in the person. I can tell there's a something strikingly different about the person, and that's when I get worried. Like, oh, we're changing the person. That's an ethical. I don't want to change the person with a pill. I want them to be in control of changing. Right? I mean, you tell me what your frame is on that.
Yeah. Well, okay. So first off, I agree with you completely about how it works for a period of time, and then a lot of people relapse.
Yeah.
Now, I think that
sometimes it works permanently. I've seen it work permanently, but I'm not sure those are real addicts. I feel like those are just dependent people who had trouble getting off.
I would disagree on that.
Well, sure, I don't have any data on that. Just my sense of it. Yeah. So, yeah.
But I would say that the problem with this idea that it doesn't work for a lot of these people is that they're hoping for the one dose miracle cure.
Yeah.
And you have to leave the country to go down to Mexico.
Yeah.
Or somewhere to get ibogaine. If it were a legitimate FDA-approved therapy, which we're also interested in working on, you might get a booster 6 months or a year later when you start to feel like, something's slipping.
Right.
So I think it's the idea of the one-dose miracle cure that really isn't the right concept.
Got it. I just don't have an opinion on the ibogaine, but talk to me about this person thing and the ethics of that.
Yeah. So what I talked about with LSD, about why I would want LSD if I was on a deserted island, is that you can't. It's harder to negotiate with. You need to surrender, but you still can fight it. So that there's a way in which there's a choice that people make to open up to something, and that often does lead to personality change. In fact, one of the big findings from the research at Hopkins and the research that we've done is that with this psilocybin mystical experience, that the dimension, the NEO, which is one of the main measures of neuroticism, extroversion, and I don't remember what the O is for, but openness, that's what it is. Yeah, that openness, personality is considered to be more or less permanent throughout your life. And there's been changes in openness in psychedelic research connected to the depth of the mystical experience. So I guess I would answer the ethical question of what you're saying is there's still an element of choice. And in a psychedelic experience, if people are wanting to go to something or resist it, it's just more painful to resist it with LSD or ibogaine. And I think we'd really need to be asking these patients or these people, are they comfortable with this personality change? Are they glad it happened, or do they see it as—
Well, okay. I'm going to push back on that because it really concerns me, that stuff, which is that, A, we, the observer, are putting a value judgment on the openness of the individual, right? Yeah. We're saying, hey, you're better. You're more open.
That's right.
And that's me saying that. Again, that's not my place, number one. Number two, this is the vampire question. In other words, before you become a vampire, right? The vampire shows up and goes, "It's great. You have to sacrifice your soul, but you live forever, and it's fantastic. And you have to eat other people and stuff." And not being a vampire is a different state than when you get to be the vampire. You may think it's great, right? But you're still a vampire, and your previous self may not have liked vampire. You see what I'm saying? It's a transformation of the person, and that just ethically is a very interesting place to be. And I get that you put the persons in control of it. To me, that mitigates it quite a bit. But we can't go, you're better off as a vampire, you're better off open because we decided that. That's a weird place for us to sit.
That's very true. Yeah. But I would say that this idea of the pre-vampire, post-vampire implies that somebody is working well pre-vampire. You've got people that are addicted to opiates that you're talking about. Their pre-state is not healthy for them in many ways, and their patients and they're seeking.
I get you. But there are other roads without becoming a vampire to giving up that priesthood. Now, if you can't, if you really can't, then that's an interesting – there. Now we got a different dilemma, right? It's like the only way we can save you is if you become a vampire. And then it kind of makes sense then to become a vampire.
Okay. Now, are you saying that because there's this pharmacological psychedelic adjunct,
yeah,
that that's different than – if you just go to therapy and you have personality change in therapy?
Well, no. What I'm saying is we think, and this may be wrong, this may be an actual – because I framed it as this. Yeah. We think in the slow process of therapy, the patient is in charge of the changes. Now, the reality is plenty of therapists, not only do they necessarily have to insert themselves into the process, they overinsert themselves into the process and do lots of bad things. I see that all the time. But I would argue that's – yeah, it's just an interesting landscape. I don't think we can solve it, but it kind of fascinates me because I don't object to the people becoming a vampire when that's all they got. I don't object to it. I just don't I don't want to be the one going, you're better as a vampire. You need to be a vampire. You understand?
Yes. Okay. Yeah. So let's get back now to this idea that you were just saying about therapists that overinsert themselves.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the essence of our method, we have to have a standardized method for FDA drug regulation, drug development research. We have to standardize the drug, but we also have to standardize the therapeutic intervention.
Yes.
And so we've developed a treatment manual. We call it inner-directed therapy. So of the 8 hours of a therapeutic session with MDMA, around half the time people's eyes are closed, they're listening to music, they're having these beautiful metaphorical stories they're telling themselves about their lives and imagery. You know, one of the vets came back, he had terrible rage after coming back from Iraq, and he had the image of the warrior self locked in a cage inside him. And so when his eyes are closed, he's sort of making friends with this warrior self, opening the cage, putting the key, you know, and realizing they have to go together for it. But people, the other half the time, people are more or less talking to the therapists. If it's LSD or psilocybin, it's more like 80 or 90% eyes closed, inner experience, the rest of the time talking to the therapist. But the essence of the method called inner-directed, is that we support what's emerging in the person. We don't do guided imagery. We don't do techniques like there'll be elements of cognitive processing therapy, cognitive behavioral therapy. There'll be elements of prolonged exposure, which we've spoken about before, to confront the trauma. But it's in response to what the patient is revealing initially. And we don't have a sense of the proper trajectory, or you must talk about your trauma now. People sometimes go and talk about beautiful experiences from their childhood that they'd forgotten to draw strength to then go into the more painful thing. So there's an element of choice in the therapeutic method, even though there's this, as the way we practice, even though there's the administration of a pharmacological agent to facilitate the process, it's still supporting people where they want to go and to try, or what's emerging. And a lot of times, we work with a fellow, Bessel van der Kolk, who's
I know him well. Wrote
The Body Keeps the Score. Yep. So he's the principal investigator of our Boston site.
Oh, fantastic.
And he's now thinking that MDMA is the best approach to PTSD.
Oh, man. Has he said that publicly?
Yes, he has. And he's written about it in his books. And also Dick Schwartz, who does internal family systems. We're doing work because people all the time under the influence of MDMA, they start saying, a part of me feels this, a part of me feels that. And you can kind of weigh internal conflicts that way. It gets externalized. So I think that what I meant to say here by talking about Bessel and The Body Keeps the Score is that sometimes we're not ready to have a conscious thought, but pains or things emerge in our body.
Yeah.
The best example that I can give for that is one time I was sitting with this guy. He was a German psychiatrist, and under the influence of MDMA, his arm became paralyzed, and he couldn't work it. It just was paralyzed, and he was like scared. And we're like, "Look, your arm is this. There's something psychosomatic going on here. Your arm is not paralyzed. We don't need to take you to the emergency room. Let's just play it out and see what happens." And he calmed down enough. And over the course of a couple hours, he told us the story about how he and his mother and his siblings were around the deathbed of their father, and they had to decide whether to take him off life support. And since he was the doctor, he wrote this order saying, take him off life support. And he said the problem was that he hated his father. And this conflict was, did he kill his father? And this was the arm that was paralyzed, was the arm that wrote the order to say, take him off life support.
Wouldn't Dr. Freud have loved this?
Yeah. And so over the course of hours, as he tells the story, then the feeling comes back to his arm and he's totally fine and not paralyzed and no damage. You know?
Wow.
So it's just to say that we support whatever's emerging, even if we and the patient don't understand it.
Well, it's funny. I have zero resistance to the idea of MDMA therapy. Though I always worry. The other thing I worry about is the timeline problem in mental health research, which is because I see this in addiction medicine all the time, that the timelines are so short. They make all kinds of crazy conclusions and, you know, sweeping mandates that are based on 3-month windows with a disease that takes years to treat and has a very long, you know, arc to it. How do you manage that issue?
Okay. Well, first off, you're totally right about that. And I think that's some of the work with psilocybin. You know, they just use like 3-week follow-ups.
Yeah, it's crazy. That's a zero. It's not pneumonia. It's not, this is a brain thing. It's a way different deal.
And you could be in the psychedelic afterglow and really tough. So the good news, well, the way we structure things is to avoid the psychedelic afterglow, our primary outcome measure between the experimental group and the control group is 2 months after the last experimental session. So that's not very long, but we also... But that's the
well, I'm guessing you personally have lots of long-term follow-up. I'm guessing it may not be published, but I'm certain you have lots of long-term experience.
Well, okay. So we do the 2-month follow-up for FDA. We do a 12-month follow-up for the insurance companies. Oh. They're not going to spend all the money if it's not durable.
Right.
We have done a 3.5-year follow-up on some of our patients.
Isn't that funny? The insurance company gets priority over the science?
The FDA says yes, but that doesn't mean that it gets adopted.
I understand.
So we've got a higher standard for the insurance company than for the FDA.
It's crazy. Yeah.
But we have done, we're doing now a very long-term follow-up to all of the people in phase two. We're in phase two.
Well, let's go to the trial now. Tell us all about the trial.
Okay. So what I started out by saying is 1992, we did the first phase one dose response safety study. Starting in 1999 and 2000, we started working on MDMA for PTSD, and we did studies in the United States, Israel, Switzerland, and Canada. And we did 16 years of that. We treated about 105 people in 6 different studies, and that was called those are small pilot studies, exploratory studies, where the purpose is to try to refine your treatment method, to figure out who's your proper patient population? Who do you exclude? Who do you include? What are your measures? You know, so 30 years from the start of MDMA of MAPS, I mean, in 1986 to November 29, 2016, we had our end of phase two meeting with FDA, and we presented our phase two data. And what we showed is that at the control group, now we felt that we have to work with the hardest patients. And so we enroll people who previously attempted suicide. A lot of PTSD studies exclude people if they've actively tried to kill themselves. And we only worked with treatment-resistant people.
Sure.
And on average, they were severe PTSD. And so what we showed, though, is that at this 2-month follow-up, the control group, 23% no longer had PTSD.
Crazy.
Now, this is after getting substantial amount of therapy.
Yeah.
Either no MDMA or low dose, very low dose therapy.
What was your control group?
Well, it's the same people who are randomly assigned, and you get basically it's 42 hours of therapy.
Got it.
So there's 3 8-hour MDMA sessions, and there's 12 90-minute non-drug psychotherapy sessions. So there's 3 90-minute sessions before the first experimental session, which is either MDMA or inactive placebo, or in phase two was low dose that didn't have a therapeutic effect but might cause some confusion. And then there's 3 of these 90-minute sessions for integration after each experimental session. And so you get 12 of these, and then the final follow-up at 2 months, and then the 1 year for the insurance companies. So what we showed in that frame, so the control group gets therapy without MDMA versus therapy with MDMA. And so we showed that 23% in the control group no longer had PTSD at the 2-month follow-up.
Wow.
But the people that got MDMA, 56% no longer had PTSD, more than twice as good. And more importantly, and in phase two, what we did is everybody that was in the control group could immediately go themselves through the experiment again, but this time get therapy with MDMA. So what we showed at the 1 year follow-up is that 2/3 no longer had PTSD. And of the 1/3 that still had PTSD, almost all, but not all, had clinically significant reductions of PTSD symptoms. So it was tremendously successful, and we had a very good safety record. And so the FDA said, yes, you can go to phase three. And phase three are the larger studies that are designed to prove safety and efficacy in order to get permission to market. So instead of going straight to phase three, which we were approved to do, we elected to go through what's called a special protocol assessment process, which is...
Is this an FDA criteria?
Yeah. It's an option. Most pharmaceutical companies...
I've never heard of it before.
Yeah.
It's interesting.
What you do is you negotiate every aspect of your drug development program, your phase three designs, your statistical analysis plan, everything, all the other animal toxicity studies, everything that they want to know. You get a complete package of what it's going to take to make the drug into a medicine. And if you can agree to this, you get what's called an agreement letter to successfully conclude the special protocol assessment process. Now, that delayed things by almost 3/4 of a year. Mm. But because of the problem of doing a double-blind study with psychedelics, I felt that we needed to do this extra negotiations with FDA because we wanted them to agree on how we're going to approach the methodological design of the studies. And we didn't want them to complain later that they didn't like what we did, because really there is no perfect way to do a double-blind study with drugs that are so strong that you usually can tell if you've taken.
Right.
So right after we succeeded in the negotiation with FDA about special protocol assessment, then they gave us breakthrough therapy designation, which is the most important designation for the most promising studies. And then we started phase three. So in October of 2020, we got the results from our first phase three study. And since then, we have started our second phase three study. Now, these studies have been delayed by COVID, but what we had agreed with FDA that we would do two phase three studies, each with 100 people, and half would get therapy without MDMA with inactive placebo, and half would get therapy with active MDMA. Hmm. And it would be this three-session model with the 12 90-minute non-drug psychotherapy sessions, and we use two therapists instead of one. So it's an unusual situation. Again, our operating approach was, how do we maximize therapeutic outcomes?
Yeah, I get it. But two therapists for the same patient or two?
For the same patient, okay, and we used a male-female team.
Interesting. So now, all potential confounding variables are trying to be controlled here, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, okay. Now we are just starting to do group therapy research. We're just in the
process. Oh, that'd be interesting too. Oof.
Yeah. And this will be probably at the Portland VA. So we'll start group therapy with vets. But we want the male-female team. It's not necessary. Most underground therapists that we talked about are one person. They do fine. But with the male-female team, a lot of times people who develop PTSD have had a series of traumas, often going into childhood. We talk about the ACE scores for adverse childhood experiences. And so to have like a well-functioning male-female support team often helps people who didn't have that when they were growing up. And also some people, you know, the sort of gender stereotypes that we have that, you know, women are more nurturing. And so sometimes, though, people will speak to the female therapist or speak to the male therapist
differently.
Differently. So anyway, that's our approach. We think that group therapy, we won't need two for one, or, you know, and we want one person eventually to be the licensed therapist and the other to be an intern or to be a student.
Why is that?
Because for the insurance company. So
I see.
And also that's a great way to train the next generation of therapists.
Sure.
To have them work as an apprentice sort of for the first person, but we'd like to keep the two person model for individuals. So anyway, we negotiated all that with FDA. We have completed our first phase three study. And just several days ago, we heard from Nature Medicine, which is one of the highest impact factor journals in medicine and in science.
Anything in the nature family is the highest prestige, the most prestige.
Yeah, and we just feel that since it's been so stigmatized, psychedelics and MDMA in particular, that we need to go for external validation. Nature Medicine said yes.
Congratulations. I can't wait to read this, and when it does come out, it'll be fantastic to see all this.
I can share the results.
Well, of course, sleep is one of the healthiest things you can do for yourself. It's the restorative part of the day. It's when you heal. We clean out literally some of the debris from our brain. And, of course, we have things that keep us awake at night. There are many, many reasons why you can't get 7 hours of sleep. But something that has been shown to be associated with improved sleep is magnesium. That's right. Believe it or not, around 75% of people don't get enough magnesium. This can explain sleep problems. Do not run to the store to buy the first magnesium supplement. They may not have full spectrum. They may not have the same benefit since there are 7 unique forms. You best if you can get all 7, and hopefully that will improve some of the calming sleep enhancing effects as well. Magnesium Breakthrough by Bioptimizers is your solution. Simply take 2 capsules before you go to bed. You'll be amazed how much better you sleep and how much more rested you feel when you wake up. For an exclusive offer for my listeners, go to magbreakthrough.com/Drew. Use Dr. Drew 10 during checkout to save 10%. Again, that is magbreakthrough.com. One word, MAGBREAKTHROUGH, magbreakthrough.com/Drew. Use code DrDrew10 at checkout to save 10%. Well, I'm sure you've had the experience of having difficulty finding a physician, finding to get an appropriate appointment. It takes forever. Or you get in there and you find out they don't take your insurance. Well, now there is the ZocDoc app. You just download it for free. Easiest way to find a physician and instantly book an appointment. Lots of choices. You can search locally. Make sure they take your insurance. You can read verified patient reviews, book an appointment. And whether you need primary care, dentist, dermatologist, psychiatrist, they have good psychiatric referrals. It's very hard to find a psychiatrist these days. They've got them. Ophthalmologists, other specialists, ZocDoc has you covered. Go to ZocDoc, ZocDoc.com/Drew. Download that ZocDoc app. Sign up for free. All of it's free. Every month, millions of people use ZocDoc. And listen, I told you, it's on my phone. And I've searched through and looked at all the excellent referrals they have there. It is ZocDoc.com. Makes healthcare easy. And now, of course, you know, is a time when we got to make sure we're appropriately getting our health taken care of. We've been so focused on COVID, it's time to get back into routine healthcare. Go to ZocDoc.com/Drew, download the ZocDoc app for free and sign up for free, and book a top-rated physician. Many are available as soon as today. That is ZocDoc.com/Drew. I think we all need to get out there and keep chanting about this weird, stigmatizing, bizarre idea that good chemicals and bad chemicals exist. And also, there's an equally high anxiety about triggering addiction in people that just have zero risk for that. Yeah. And not only that, even somebody with risk, you know, there's ways to manage that risk. And by the way, the genetic burden of one given risk is not the same as the genetic burden of another risk and whatever environmental cofactors might be contributing. So, and it's very concerning to me. It's very concerning because we just seem completely confused as at least – are you in the United States or are you in Canada?
I'm in Boston.
You're in Boston. You talked to me about Montreal before the microphone heated up. I was wondering.
Yeah.
I'm talking about. And we're just grave confusion out here.
Yeah. Now, one of the things that's interesting is that several of the people in our studies have said, I don't know why they call this ecstasy. Because when you're a PTSD patient and you take it in therapy and you're working through problems, it's not like you pop the pill and now you love everybody and everything's easy.
Yeah.
The other thing is that we've tracked people afterwards. We don't see them going to use illegal ecstasy on their own after the therapy.
No, it's not the way it works.
People don't associate this painful therapeutic process with fun. But there's also been a study in England with David Nutt, Ben Sessa, that was with MDMA for alcohol use disorder.
Oh, yeah, I've seen that. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it works.
It worked.
Yeah.
Because a lot of times people are driven to drug abuse because of unprocessed trauma. So if you
I would just say the way I think of it is trauma is the rocket fuel for addiction.
Yes.
I wouldn't put it as a causative necessarily so much as the rocket fuel. And it certainly contributes to why somebody is looking outside of their body to regulate the internal experience. Trauma is the inciting – but it's not necessarily trauma, but trauma is the big inciting agent. And then if you also have trauma, then now you've got – and you have the genetics for addiction. Now you've got the rocket fuel in place. And I think some of it – is I'm going to interview Alan Shore again in a couple of days, actually tomorrow, and he has this concept of somatoform dissociation. Have you heard his stuff? I think that's some of what trauma does. It disorganizes what comes out of the body in terms of the feeling states that we experience.
Yeah, yeah.
And they become intolerable, and you have to reorganize that. You have to re-regulate that. And for whatever reasons, these drugs seem to accelerate that process, particularly for people that are blocked.
Yeah, yeah, they do, and so we've not seen that fear of people,
And I got to say, back to the vampire thing I was talking about earlier, I am biased. You know, we all have our clinical bias, right? Yeah. And I get to see throughout my clinical career saw lots of people that abuse these drugs, and I saw the neurotoxic effects. I saw lots of terrible consequences from people that used a lot of both LSD or MDMA, and it ain't good. But it. You know, it's back to your original statement of who said it, Perseus or
Paracelsus.
Yeah, that you can hurt yourself with just about anything. And that's what people need to understand. And properly studied, we can figure out where that spot is. You know what I mean? To make sure that we do no harm.
Yeah, and our therapeutic approach is only a few doses of MDMA. It's not like here you take this every day for the rest of your life.
Of course,
it's just a few deep interventions. And I think the goal for us, again, we're a nonprofit pharma, even though we own the for-profit benefit corp. Our goal is not to maximize money. It's to give people the deepest therapy we can give with the fewest sessions possible so that then they don't need drugs at all.
Right.
And that's to affect their baseline. And so the results from the phase three, the first thing that they showed is that it's very – we had one person who attempted to kill herself twice during the study. And we had another person who had such strong suicidal ideation that she checked herself into a hospital to avoid killing herself. As it turned out, at the end of the study, both were in the placebo group.
Oh, my goodness. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah, because they had we also require people to stop SSRIs or stop any psychiatric medicine.
Oh, ooh. Yeah, that's dangerous. So, okay, there you go.
It has to be done in a tapered process.
It's highly controlled, et cetera. I'm not taking issue with it. I'm just saying that.
But it is.
It's a hard study.
This filter off of people that the SSRIs often blunt the highs and the lows.
Yep.
But they make it tolerable for people. But they still, to get into our study, have to have severe PTSD. So, and when you give MDMA to people who are on SSRIs, the SSRIs blunt the effect of the MDMA.
Right. I am aware of that.
Yeah.
Right. Rick, I'm running out of time. Let's wrap it up.
Okay. So our findings for our first phase three study were the statistical findings were robust. What that means is that you have to get 0.05, which is 1 out of 20 that it's due to chance. We had 1 out of 10,000. We had 0.0001.
That's your p-value.
Yeah.
That's
then
great.
You look at effect sizes because you can have statistical significance about trivial effects. So just a high statistical significance doesn't mean anything by itself.
Which is another problem in mental health research. So good. What'd you find?
Yeah. Well, what we did is we looked at it two ways. One is called placebo subtracted effect size. That's the way the FDA wants us to look at it. So that means you take, you're sort of looking at your control group and you sort of subtract those benefits from the experimental group and what you're left
right.
with.
Right. So whatever benefit was provided by placebo minus is taken away, backed out of the actual therapeutic group.
Yeah. Except for us, the placebo is therapy.
Yeah.
All right, so we have a 0.91 effect size, placebo subtracted, which is large. It's way better than SSRIs. It's actually terrific. 0.91.
Great.
However, when you do the within subjects effect size, when you, because the 0.91 is you've subtracted the therapy out of the MDMA plus therapy, you're only left with the MDMA effect.
Yep.
In the subjects that got both, they had a 2.1 effect size.
That's amazing.
So that's really, 2X. And so safety record, p-value. The other thing is we had no significant variability according to the sites. We had 15 sites, two in Israel, two in Canada, one in Montreal, one in Vancouver, and 11 throughout the United States. So that's a big thing for the FDA, too.
Because how big was your N?
It was just 90 people.
90 in each group or 90 total?
90 total.
Yeah.
And so, but we pre-agreed that with the FDA because what they said is that
good. Because I would say that's where they push back on you.
Yeah, so, but they can't.
Yeah,
they,
good.
Because they said that we can prove efficacy quicker, smaller number of subjects than they want to see for safety. So because of COVID, they let us go down from 100 to 90. The second phase 3 study is going to be 100. We've already done over 100 in phase 2. And so we have a lot of data. So what we showed is that there's no effect by site, which means that you don't have two therapists over here that are treating 50% of your people and are doing great and everybody else isn't figuring it out.
Yeah.
So what it means is it can scale. And so it meets the criteria for potential FDA approval on the basis of one phase 3 study with confirmatory evidence from phase 2 studies. And we've applied to the FDA for that. We think they're going to reject it because it's so new and controversial. They're going to want us to do the second phase 3 study.
Oh, interesting.
We're doing it anyway. But the results were fantastic.
I'm a little surprised by it because this is something that's been swirling around for so long. And it's MDMA therapeutic, you know, as an adjunct to therapeutic. I don't know. I think they might be more positive than you think. This has been coming for a long time.
It's bureaucratic self-protectionism.
Yeah.
So what's going on is because we were protected by the special protocol assessment.
Yeah.
We have of the two people I mentioned, the first one has to be a therapist, licensed therapist. Second one doesn't even need a license.
Right.
Okay. Now FDA has tried to impose on the psilocybin researchers and on all of our new studies that the lead person needs to have an MD or a PhD, which doesn't make sense at all. And they want a doctor on site rather than on call, which we don't have to have. We need a doctor for prescribing and for screening, but we don't need a doctor on site. That's going to increase costs and it really doesn't make sense. So we're arguing these things out with FDA, but we see them being more concerned. They believe we're going to succeed. They believe they're going to end up approving it, but they're worried that if something goes wrong, then they get blamed.
I see. I get it. Yeah, they're trying to really, like as you said, protect themselves. Well, listen, Dr. Doblone, I've got to wrap this thing up. It's been a fascinating conversation. I hope you'll come back and discuss.
I love it.
We think about it. We really just did a survey and did one chemical. There's multiple other chemicals we could discuss equally as in detail, different contexts, but there's a lot out there. And I've always had great admiration for MAPS. Congratulations on.
Thank you.
I actually wanted to do a documentary series on the therapeutic uses of hallucinogenics. Wow. I actually pitched it around and it got rejected everywhere, but maybe it's the same thing you're dealing with the FDA.
Times have changed, though.
I was going to say, I've noticed Netflix doing a whole bunch of stuff now. And they're actually kind of not well done, in my humble opinion. I think we could do a much better job. But be that as it may, I enjoy speaking to you. I've always wanted to talk to you. I've always been watching MAPS sort of as a admiringly from afar. And to really dig in with you has been a real pleasure. And good luck with this. I mean, you're just trying to help people. That's all we're all trying to do here. We're trying to help and not hurt. That's our goal. But lots to discuss. And it's a brave new world there you're getting into. And I think it will have value. I've always said, if I were dealing with end-of-life stuff, I would think very seriously about some hallucinogenic if I were having trouble.
Or psychedelic.
Psychedelic. I got to get my nomenclature right. Got to get that corrected. Again, I hope you'll come back. In the meantime, I thank you for this, and we will see everyone next time.
Thank you.
For calling times and topics, follow the show on Twitter at Dr. Drew Podcast. That's DRDREW Podcast. The music from today's episode can be found on the Swingin' Sounds of the Dr. Drew Podcast, now available on iTunes. And while you're there, don't forget to rate the show. The Dr. Drew Podcast is a Corolla Digital production and is produced by Chris Loxamana and Gary Smith. For more information, go to drdrew.com. All conversation and information exchanged during the participation in the Dr. Drew Podcast is intended for educational and entertainment purposes.
purposes only. Do not confuse this with treatment or medical advice or direction. Nothing on these podcasts supplement or supersede the relationship and direction of your medical caretakers. Although Dr. Drew is a licensed physician with specialty board certifications by the American Board of Internal Medicine and the American Board of Addiction Medicine, he is not functioning as a physician in this environment. The same applies to any professionals who may appear on the podcast or drdrew.com.